questions that you want to make, I'm ready for them.
Hi, I'm Carol T. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Carol.
My sobriety date is July 22nd, 1988. Put in other terms, that's 10,551 days as a few minutes ago. So since my last drink, that's day at a time, and that's how I did this. I'm really grateful to Sam and to Gary for getting me here tonight and giving me this honor and this chance to tell my story. It's just something I'm very grateful to do. So, there was this guy and he walks into a bar. Actually a nightclub, and he goes in and he starts drinking and he's really enjoying the music. And then he starts dancing, and he enjoys his dance partners, and he's drinking and dancing and drinking, and he has a great old time. So he decides to do it again the next night, and the next night, and the next night. And this goes on for years until he comes to the realization that if he gets a job in the bar, not only can he drink all night and drink after hours, but he can get paid for it. Okay? So I know this sounds like a joke, but if there is a joke, it's on me because I just told you my story. This guy walks into a bar, and that's what happened. I did this for about a bunch of years working in bars, and then it came to the beginning of 1988 when my fiance, which I also got out of a bar as a part of the deal, She and I decided as a New Year's resolution, maybe we were drinking and partying a little too much and we should quit. So we did as a New Year's resolution, and that lasted about 11 days. And what happened then was I suggested we go visit some friends, and that meant, hey, we're back at the races, and we started all over again. What happened was in a few months she started acting real weird. She was a nurse in the local hospital in Charlottesville, and what I didn't realize was that she'd gotten into the medicine cabinet. She was diverting Demerol on paper and taking the extra dose that she was creating and shooting at IM. I had no clue what was going on. I questioned about the bruise on her arms and on her leg, that she just made up stuff. And finally, they figured out at the hospital what she was doing. And one day she came to my job site crying, and they were taking her away. She'd been given the choice of either going to a 28-day treatment program or going to jail. And so it was a pretty easy choice. So I was pretty freaked out because I had no clue what was going on. And so a few days later, I went to the visitor's day. We sat in a lecture. They separated us, sent me to an Al-Anon meeting, which I totally didn't understand. And then we got an hour or so together for visitor's day. The next week, I went back. And what happened was she said, if you will come, instead of the Al-Anon meeting, come with me to go to the AA meeting, then we can hold hands for an hour, an extra hour. I only get to see a few hours a week. So we went to the door of the meeting, and a staff person was there. And they stopped me and said, you don't belong here. And I lied and said, oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. Well, I wasn't lying, but I just didn't know it. And what happened was, if you had asked me, if I had been able to be honest, what I could have said was, I am a pothead who drinks a little bit. Now, I'm here for AA, and I'm going to talk AA, but the way I dealt back then with things is I had a drink in one hand and something else in the other hand. And if I started doing less of this one, I started doing more of this one. And if I started doing less of this one, I started doing more of this one. And so for a while, this story merges there. And Anyway, so I was a pothead that drank a little bit. And it was, it took me, well, that meeting I started identifying in immediately. Because I really had been tired. I'd been knowing for years there was something wrong, and I knew that I drank too much, and I partied too much. I worked in bars. My life was just not what it could be, and I'm just not a happy camper. And so I started going to meetings, and a lot of them were like I found out where she was going to go. They were busing her group to some, and I'd go to that meeting and hold hands with her. But I was going to meetings. She got out in 28 days, and they wanted her to go to a 90-day program. And she begged them to let her stay home for 2 weeks. And the reason was to teach me how to run the household, because I had no clue. Because I'd been a kid. I started drinking when I was 17 years old, and here 17 years later, I was still 17. She had to teach me how to pay bills, where to send them, how to dress them, how to do that, how to pay rent, how to do all this stuff. She had 2 weeks to teach me this. Because my life was I either lived off my parents or I lived off a girlfriend. I just lived off of other people. Because drinking and drugging was my life. That was what I did. I wouldn't have told you that. I didn't think that. But that's really, looking back, that's what I did. That was my life. And so she went to a 90-day program, and that's when I started going to more meetings. Now, I will say at first, and there's a reason for this, at first I related more to NA, and I went to NA meetings in Charlottesville. And at the time, there were very few of them and far between. And I went there for months. So I went to some AA meetings as well. And I finally, I got a temporary sponsor. But because of a small fishbowl of NA, it was just, everybody knew everybody's business and they were getting in mine. And not in a helpful way, but in actually a detrimental way. And I was going to meetings and getting angry, and I finally got a good sponsor who went to AA, and he said, "Go where you find your recovery." So I started going to AA meetings, but I'm sitting in an AA meeting one night, and I'm wondering, why am I here? You know, I really should be in there. They've chased me. I really should be in the other fellowship. And this guy says words I will never forget. He says, "And I remember all the stupid things that I did when I was drinking." And it was like a dam burst in my head. And all of a sudden, all these things started coming to light. It's like after that first olive out of the bottle, the rest came tumbling out. And I started remembering all these stupid things that I'd done when I was drinking. And I still didn't think that I was an alcoholic. I still didn't really understand that I had this disease that I could not stop. But I did kind of understand it because I had tried to stop through the years. I had white-knuckled. I got a few months white-knuckling, just, you know, trying by sheer willpower. And, you know, if not drinking was enough, then I'd be okay and I wouldn't need AA. But that's not what I needed. I needed to learn how to live. I needed to learn how to grow up. I needed to learn how to take responsibility, and I need to I needed to learn how to interact with people and to be a member of society. I wasn't. That's not what I was. So one of the things that happened was while she was in treatment the second time, I say it's actually an extension the first. I don't mean that she went, you know, separately, but while she was there, my car insurance I'd had with my parents didn't work anymore, and I had to get car insurance. And so she hooked me up with her family's insurance company, and the man came over to my house. And we're signing the papers and doing everything, and it comes out that she's in treatment. And I say, "Well, I've got 30 days. I showed him my chip. And he looked at me and he said, "Look, you know, that's really nice that you're doing that, but if I find out, you know," he says, "it doesn't work for everybody. And if I find out that you're drinking, if you get pulled by the cops drinking, I'm going to yank your license so fast you won't believe it." And I said, "Okay, don't worry about it. You know, I'm cool." So I started getting involved. I started service work. I started cleaning ashtrays because there were smoking meetings in. I set up chairs. I made coffee, and I started doing this for years. She got out and got upset that I wanted to go to meetings all the time, even though she was supposed to, too. But I still went to them, and we got married. And what's kind of funny, in a way, is when I got honest, see, when we got in the fellowship together, or when we got in recovery together, I fudged my recovery date to make mine match with her. So every time she got up, I'd get up with her, and we'd get our, you know, we'd celebrate together with getting our chips and our medallions. And what I realized years later, after we were divorced, that we got married on my 1 year clean anniversary. We got right on the very date. So every time I celebrate an anniversary, that's, you know, minus one would have been my wedding anniversary. But what happened was she kept talking about that when 3 years hit, she was going to party. And she was going to celebrate by partying. Well, that didn't bother me too much. I was figured I'd deal with that when I got to it. But then she asked me to leave, and we started, you know, I was really shocked. Nobody in my family had ever been divorced. I couldn't believe it. And it's not what I wanted. And I was freaking out, and I didn't tell anybody because I was afraid the word was going to get around in AA and then people would start hitting on her. And yeah, I just wouldn't tell anybody. My sponsor, God bless his heart, found out about it and told me two things. And the main thing was to get out of the house. If she wanted me out, get out. And I found a roommate and I moved out. And we were in limbo for about a year and a half. So legally we were married for 3 years, but we lived together about a year and a half. And then it was limbo until we finally divorced. And I tell you that because this is when my relationship with the power greater than myself started kicking in. And I'd heard, you know, I knew by this point the first step was real for me. I could not do this. I could not do this by myself. There's no way. I couldn't quit. I tried it. I tried it a bunch of times. I couldn't do it. And that was the easy one to get. The next part was to restore me to sanity. You know, there's I figured there had to be a higher power. I was brought up in the Methodist Church, and I did all the things, and I went to Sunday school, and I grew up, and I didn't have this great concept of God. What I did have was this feeling of being outside of everything, feeling outside and not a part. I didn't fit in. There was something wrong with me that just didn't fit in, and I don't know what the heck that was, but it was terrible, and I felt that all the time, and I started just not wanting to face life. I didn't want to die, but I didn't want to live this way. Excuse me. I didn't want to live this way. I couldn't stand it. And finally, one night on a Saturday night, I got in a fight with my parents, and I disappeared for a while, and my mother came to get me sitting on the staircase. I was 14. And she came up, she started yelling at me, because where I was sitting, it looked like I was looking through a doorway into the family room and watching the TV, and we'd gotten a fight over the TV. And she thought I was just being obstinate. And then she looked at me and she realized I had a belt around my neck and I wasn't breathing. And she brought me down to she called for help. My brother and my father got me down from, I was just sitting on the stairwell and slipped a couple of steps down that tightened up the noose. And when I tried to get it off, I couldn't. And I just like, oh well. And I put my hands down beside me and passed out. The reason I tell you about this, I've never wanted to die, and I think a lot of us have thought about suicide, and I don't want to make this a suicide meeting, but the point is that when I started drinking, those feelings went away. When I started drinking, all that stuff, all that thing about not wanting to feel what I felt, suddenly, I mean, I remember it was in, I think, probably 1972, and a friend of mine, we were probably 16, he brought a bottle of cold duck. And we guzzled that thing, and I felt ways I had never felt before. And it was amazing because now I just didn't care about the way I normally felt. I didn't care whether I fit in. In fact, I kind of felt like I fit in. We're sitting there together drinking this bottle. And I started drinking, and he turned me on to the other stuff. I started smoking, not cigarettes. And I just this became a way of life because I didn't have to feel that way anymore. So when another part of when my mother found me, they put me in the hospital for 10 days and then they sent me to a children's rehab center in Richmond, and I went there for 6 months. So when I came out and went back to school in ninth grade, there's that crazy guy that hung himself or jumped off a bridge or slit his wrist or whatever the story de jure was. But there I was even more of an outsider. And now, drinking, I didn't care. I was one of the group. I was in the bar with everybody. I was, you know, a part of it. Except I really wasn't. I probably, after several years, I felt more alone than I ever felt in my whole life. I could be in a crowd in the middle of everybody and still feel outside. Still feel not a part of this thing. So restore me to sanity? Can you restore somebody who's never been there? Because I didn't think, I was that crazy guy that killed himself. I didn't think that I could be restored to anything. And then people started, you know, working with me and convincing me that I was full of beans. And but then looking at the higher power, looking at the third step, I knew darn well I couldn't do this. And there were people in these meetings that were happy to be alive, happy to be there, not drinking for days, weeks, months, years, multiple years. Months is pretty important to me. I thought that was a pretty big deal. But there they were, and they were living life, and they were happy. And I didn't understand it, but I wanted some of that. Be laughing and kidding, you know. I used to get with people, are you cool? Hey, you want to go catch one? And it's like, now it's like, are you cool? You don't drink? Me neither. Bill W., all right, yeah, let's do this. And meeting people all over. I go to meetings everywhere I go. I've traveled the United States, and I'll go to local meetings wherever I go. And that's a whole nother story. I got off from telling you the story. I guess everything I just told you leads up to this. My wife wanted a divorce, and I didn't want a divorce because my ego said that nobody in my family ever did that, and I didn't want to be the first. And so I remember living with this guy and his family in their apartment. He heard my plight, and he gave me a room, and we were housemates for 6 months or so. I remember right where I was. And I was standing in my room by the desk, and I standing there, and out loud I said, God, I don't know what you want from me. I want to be married. I don't know if you want, so here's what I want to do. If you want me married, okay. And if you don't want me married, okay. Your will be done, whatever it is. And I didn't want his will to be done because it turned out that we never got back together and we got divorced. And that was God's will. And why would I say that's God's will? Because one day, about 3 years after I got sober, I'm walking down. This is a bit after we got married. It was about 3 years after married. So anyway, it was after 3 years. Somebody bumped me at Fridays after five. It was when it was the old grass bowl. And somebody walked by me and they just accidentally clipped my elbow. And it turned out it was my ex-wife. And she had a beer in her hand. And I was stunned, and I walked the mall to find somebody, because back then they say if you're ever alone and it's between meetings, walk down the mall, you'll see somebody in recovery. And I did. And I found somebody, and I talked about it. And it turns out that I'd helped her get her license back. She lost her nursing license. I helped her get it back by getting her to meetings and doing everything. And then she wanted a divorce. And she got the divorce, and she met somebody else in AA, and they got on the revolving door plan. She lost her license twice again, and last I heard, she's a waitress somewhere. But we haven't talked in 25 years or so. I have no clue, except what people tell me. That would have been me. I would have been drinking with her. I would have been drugging with her if I was still alive. And chances are I wouldn't be. Chances are strong I wouldn't be alive. And that's the first where I started really turning my will over, just saying, God, you know, I can't handle this. You tell me what you want. And he did. There's so many stories. You know, I didn't know you were going to read that part. I just heard a speaker tape a while back, and they talked about the part in the book of our story is about our relationship with God. And I've told my story a bunch of times, but I haven't really talked on the angle of how, you know, what happened between me and God, my relationship. I prayed foxhole prayers like everybody does. Oh, God, get me out of this. If you get me out of this, you know, if I don't get caught, I'll do whatever you want me to do. And I had nothing against church. Like when I was white knuckling, the thing about white knuckling was I wasn't drinking and I did all the outside stuff. I had real long hair. I cut my hair. I was wearing t-shirts and jeans. I'm suddenly wearing suits and ties. I'm going to church. I join the choir. I get involved. But I'm still the sick soul that I was because I was doing the outside stuff. I wasn't doing the inside stuff. And I worked the steps. I got with my sponsor and started working the steps. And he's one of those sponsors that asked me about my deepest, darkest secret. And I told him, and he's like, is that it? I'm like, yeah. And by the way, this has been the most amazing weekend. My sponsor and I worked together for like 5 or 6 years before he moved to Boston. He was at my first wedding. He walked me through my divorce. And 15 years ago, he came to my second wedding. And he came into town this weekend, first time he's been in town for 15 years. And I got to see him and his grown daughter, and it's amazing. But this man saved my life. He's one of, well, there's so many people, I can't tell you how many people saved my life. But it will tell you that I've had three sponsors in my bunch of years in the program, and they helped save my life, literally. I'll tell you a little bit more about the first one, how he did it, but all of them did it. And why did they do it? To work their 12-step. Three people helped save my life, and probably many more, by working their 12-step, by passing on what they got. And the way I pay my first sponsor and the other two is to pass on what I got from them. And I'm jumping ahead of myself. I got 5 years in the program. I'm divorced now. I'm still going through it. Friends that I used to party with are dying. I go to one guy, the first guy that ever showed me a 12-step trinket chip. I'm standing by his coffin. I'm looking at him, and he came in a year before I did. And I'm like, how did I get it and he didn't? And I don't understand. I'm looking in him. And then another friend, I used to see him all the time. He came in and lost his family, his first wife. And 5 years later, I give him his chip. And the next week, he announced he's lost his second wife. And he's back where he started 5 years ago. And I told him that, you know, people cared. And we hugged each other and told each other on that Tuesday night that, you know, he said, I love you. And I said, I love you too. And 4 days later, he pulled a shotgun out and took his wife. And I understood that. I understood it. And I'm at this place in my life where I got 5 years and I am Mr. Recovery. I got this thing. I know how to do this. I know to go to meetings. I know to do 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor. I know all this stuff. And thank God my sponsor is watching me, because he realizes that I'm going through one of the toughest times of my whole life. That I'm watching people die. And he tells me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Again, it was 2 years to, you know, I was 2 years into recovery when I completed my first 90 meetings in 90 days. I could say, you ought to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, but I didn't do it until I had 2 years. And now it was 5 years, and he's telling me to do it. So I do it. I go to meetings. I find a way. I'm working odd jobs, but I find ways to get to meetings and meetings and meetings. And then it's up. I'm going to back to school, to community college, and I say, I can't do, I say, what do you want me to do now? He says, do 90 meetings again. And I'm like, I'm not sure I can do that. And he said, well, do as many as you can. So I'm going to meetings 6 days a week, and the seventh day I'm seeing my sponsor. And he helped me get through this. He helped me get through it. He told me that I needed outside help. And he himself is a clinical psychologist. And he told me that I needed help. And I told him, well, I got this new job, but insurance doesn't kick in for 6 months. So he's sending me to all these meetings. And then my friend took his life, and I am really about to lose it. And the insurance kicks in, and I'm able to get outside help like I was instructed to do. In my sponsor was there the whole time, and he knew. He told me later that he knew I was on the verge of suicide because I was getting this program, and it was so good. There were so many things about it, but I still wasn't, I guess, getting the real getting the God element. And one thing that happened leading up to my friend taking his life was I started going to meetings, and every time I go to a meeting, it was a first step meeting. And I'm like, what? I had moved out of Charlottesville to my grandmother's house 25 miles away, and I was going to the Fluvanna meetings, and I was doing, you know, all these meetings. But everyone I went to, what do y'all want to talk about? How about we talk about the first step? Well, I got real tired of it, so I started trying to go get away from this. I started going to Charlottesville's meetings, and it's like every time that I went to a meeting, it was the first step meeting, even in Charlottesville. And I think God was trying to tell me something. So when I got the call that my friend had taken his life, which really devastated me, suddenly the one thing hit me more than anything was, I cannot drink over this. I cannot drink over this. You can say that was God. I don't care what you call it. I was protected enough that I reached out. I called my sponsor. I called my friends. I called everybody until a dear friend just said, come on over and let me cry. And then I went to a meeting that night, and I cried for weeks talking about this. But for the first time, why I'm crying is not because I'm a big crybaby. It's because I actually care about people. For the first time in my life, I'm developing relationships in recovery. I'm caring about people where I was so self-centered. It's our self-centeredness that kills us. It says it in the book. I think it's probably 62. It's our self-centeredness, our selfishness that kills us. And I was so self-centered, selfishness, self-centered, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us. Well, I'll pick that back up because that's part of the story, too. But so now I'm caring about people, and I'm sharing, and I'm doing lots and lots of service work, and I am working the steps, and my sponsor moves, and I get another sponsor, and life happens. Now, one thing, my life is so much better than it ever was, but I had a grand sponsor tell me, a grand sponsee one time, say that one thing that disturbed him was that a lot of people talk about how great recovery is, and you know, his life was sucking at that point. And I want to tell you, life is life. In recovery, life is life. My life is a lot better, but it's not rainbows and butterflies. It's life. But I am actually trying to deal with it and be responsible and trying to make amends and trying to clean up my side of the street and doing 10 steps. And I do 11 steps. You know, sometimes I'm kicking and screaming as I'm being dragged to do these things, but that's what I do these days is I work steps. And I work the steps with the different sponsors, and I work the step with a group that really we studied the 164 pages. And we really did the four-step by columns. And I really started seeing things differently, and things started changing more and more because I started really realizing my part, that it was my selfishness, that you know, a lot of times what people do to me and I get resentful about, they're not actions, they're reactions because of the stuff that I brought to the dance. You know, when we interact with each other, it's kind of a dance. And, you know, it's one thing if somebody calls me a dirty name, but it's another thing if I flipped him off in the first place, you know. It's a lot of times that what people do to me is because of something that I did in the first place. And when I did the columns, I started realizing what my part was. I started realizing that they weren't doing this out of nowhere, you know. We step on toes of our fellows, and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that sometime in the past, we have made decisions based on self which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And I started realizing that more and more. And I started really wanting to clean up my act and clean, you know, the better I treat you, the better you're going to treat me. It just works that way. Generally speaking, that's the way. And a lot of great things happened. Now, one thing that I want to tell about is I am talking about God here some, and I think everybody in here is more spiritual than me. I think everybody's more religious than me. Y'all got this down better than I do, because that's the way I do. Everybody, you know, I judge my insides by everybody else's outsides. Everybody's doing better than me. And I don't think that I'm that religious, and I don't think my faith is that strong. And I never have thought it was that strong until I got tested. And one time I had a sponsee who called me up. And he'd gotten in some serious trouble. And he had one of those machines where you had to breathe to start your car. And he got 4 false positives. He'd come out of an AA meeting. And he'd blow into the thing, start his car, and it says, "You're drunk. You've been drinking. The car's not going to start." And he called me up this night. And I'll try to make this a short version of the story. But he called me up this Saturday night. And he knew in his mind what was going to happen. He knew that Tuesday he had to go see his PO. And he had lied in the past sometime before, before relapse. He lied to her before. And now we'd been working for months. And I was really amazed at what he was doing. And here he's calling me. And I just know that this guy had been working the program with me for quite some months. He'd done the steps. He was doing service work. And he's telling me that he's going to maybe go to jail Tuesday. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. You know, God's not going to drop you. And I'm trying to explain because, yeah, I've seen so many. I used to think I was a miracle and you're all miracles, but this program is a miracle. This program is a miracle. It is a miracle. I don't care whether you believe in it or not. But it's a miracle, and it works, and I've seen it work for so many people, and I've seen people get out of so much trouble. I've seen people's lives turn around. I've seen people get back with their families. I've just seen so much good stuff that I believe in, and I'm trying to explain to him. And I am really frustrated because all I can say is, I know this is going to work. I know this is going to work. You're going to be all right. This is going to work out. It's going to happen. And I'm trying to explain it. And I'm sitting there kind of pounding. But in my heart of hearts, absolutely, like I know the sun's going to shine. I'm going to take my next breath. I know in my heart of hearts that he's going to be all right, that God's not going to drop him. And I can't figure the words out. And I'm so frustrated. But I keep saying, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. And then I think God took over something. I don't know. He tells me, and I still don't remember it this way, but he tells me that I said, let's talk about the elephant in the room. I do remember saying, I know if it was me, I would be thinking about drinking. And he goes, well, as a matter of fact, I am. And I went, oh, I didn't really think he was thinking that. And now, you know, I realize truly how scary it is. And all I can say is, this is going to work out. And when we're through, you probably don't want to hear this, but when we're through this phone call, I want you to hang up the phone, get down on your knees, and thank God for the situation, because it's going to work out. And this is going to increase your relationship with your higher power. I told him that. And he did. And he called back Monday afternoon, and without a lot of details, he said the miracle happened. He'd been in a doctor's office, and the PO called because they'd been interacting, and the doctor explained that she could give a definitive test to tell whether he'd been drinking or not and clear up all doubt. And the PO argued for a while, said she'd get back to her supervisor, and then called back while he was in the office and said, yes, do the test. And he got off because he hadn't been drinking. And I knew this. So that's faith. Okay, maybe I'm not the most religious. Maybe I don't always drop to my knees all the time. Maybe I don't pray. Maybe I don't go to church enough. But AA has showed me that there is a power greater than myself that can do something. Look, I thought I could get a year or two, maybe 3 years at the max. And I've got over 28 years. That's, 9 times more than I thought what I could get. And I didn't do this. I had so much help. So maybe, I don't know whether it's a bearded guy in the sky or it's the force or the universe or what works here, but there's something that's bigger than me. Maybe it's AA. I don't know what it is, and I don't care what it is. It doesn't matter to me. There's something. You know, I do believe in God with skin because that's you. That's me. That's all of us. We get together in a room and we start talking and stuff comes out of our mouths. Somebody's hurting and somebody else says, I've been there and here's what I did. Or somebody says something and somebody a week later remembers that one thing they heard in the meeting. You just don't know how this thing works, and I don't care how it works. I just know that I hadn't had to drink. But what I do know is that I have got to take care of my emotional sobriety. It is not for me. It is not. I'm not worried about drinking. And I don't say that out of, you know, false pride or anything. I could drink. I could go out here tonight and drink. I could. But if I am paying attention to my spirituality, that's how I take care of my emotional sobriety. If I see myself getting upset, then I have to stop and either call somebody or do something quickly. At work, I run to the bathroom. When somebody upsets me, I get upset about somebody, I run to the bathroom. I call it the prayer closet. And I have a little talk with me and I have a little talk with God. And I found, really, that people don't do stuff to me. It's not like just what I said before. A lot of times, it's like the 10-step axiom. If we are disturbed, there's no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with us. What's wrong? Well, I'm disturbed. That's it. I'm disturbed, and I can't be disturbed. That's affecting my emotional sobriety. So I have to look at it. I can't change the other person. I can't change what they do. But I can change how I look at it, how I feel about it, and call my sponsor, and call all sorts of people. I can do something about it. I can pray over it. And that's how I deal with it. It's not what's going on. It's not what happens in the world. It's what happens in my head. And if I let that go off, then I'm probably going to drink because I'll get feeling so bad, so resentful that I can't focus on what's going on. And then I just get upset, and then I fall apart, and I will probably drink. So I've worked the steps through the years, and one night I got a call. It was about 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, and the call was from my sister-in-law, and my father just died. Now, my mother was in an institution with Alzheimer's at that point, and Dad had just had dinner, was going to watch a football game, put his plates in the kitchen, and went back and keeled over and died like that just suddenly. And at 10 o'clock at night, I realized I have my wife and I are about to commit to a 30-mile drive and to join with my older brother and my younger brother and wait there till the body was taken away. My younger brother and his wife took care of my father, or they lived down the driveway and they just saw after him. So they found him dead, and now we go there and we join. We're waiting for the body to be taken away. And my father was an antique dealer, and he had a couple of safes. He had a shop on the property, and he had two safes. And we knew that he had a will, and we knew what the will was, and we knew that he had some money in there, and we figured we will see if we to pay for the funeral and everything. So they're my brother and my sister-in-law, they're digging through these two safes, and it's all business, money, papers, all this stuff. And then suddenly, my sister-in-law hands me a couple of sheets of paper, and I look at them, and it says "to Dad" on top of it. And what it is a 9-step letter that I had written to my father 15 years earlier. The only piece of non-business paper or non-money in that whole safe was my 9-step letter to my dad. It meant that much to him. I told him, you know, what I'd done, and that I, you know, beyond sorry, you know, that thank you for standing with me through all this stuff that I put y'all through, the hell that I put you through. And I told him the good things that I had gotten from him and talked about what a good dad he really was, despite the way I'd behaved. And that meant that much to him. My dad's laying in the other room. I don't know if he'd been pulled out by then. I wouldn't look. But I do know that that was the last message I got from my dad. There's so many other really good things. There's another thing I want to tell you. I am responsible today. I'm responsible for my recovery. I'm responsible to show up at work, to do the things I do as a citizen. I'm responsible. I got married 15 years ago to a woman that I would have never married before, never would have married me. She had too much sense to marry me, to at least had I been drunk and all. And so we do everything that a responsible couple do, and we decided to get some life insurance. And so I called my insurance company, and they were going to I've got this young, hot-to-trot insurance agent, and he's going to sell his first life insurance policy to us. And he's really excited about this, so he's going to come to our house one evening after work. And he's bringing his boss with him so his boss can help him. His first time out, his boss is going to help him through this. So they come in the house, and we sit at the table, and I start looking at the boss, and I start grinning. I'm grinning, and at the end of the meeting, we're talking, we finish, we sign the papers, and I look at the boss, and I say, "Do I look familiar to you?" And he goes, "Well, you kind of do." And I said, 22 years ago, you gave me car insurance, and I showed you my 30-day chip. And I just want to show you my 22-year chip now. How many chances do we get like that? I always wanted the parade. I am sober and all this. I wanted the parade, and that's as close as I'm ever going to get to having a parade is that. But now what helps me most of all, besides working the 11th step and the 10th step, is the 12th step. And, I heard somebody totally outside of, it was a woman at lunch yesterday, and she said, you cannot give a blessing without receiving a blessing. She was talking about she works with people, illiterate people, and she teaches them to read. I think now she's teaching English as a second language, and she was talking about people she's working with. And she's helping them, but she feels like she gets so much out of it. Well, that's the 12th step with me. I'm working with sponsees. I couldn't understand my sponsor wanting to work with me in my first one, and I couldn't understand. Then people started calling me and asking me for help, and I started realizing, that this is an amazing thing. I remember the first time I called somebody, I had a brand new sponsee that relapsed. And my sponsor had warned me that was going to happen. I didn't see it coming. And I called the guy up, and I said I was going to this meeting. I picked this kid up, and he didn't want to go because he's drinking. And and my friend on the other end said, "Well, what you need to do is to go to a meeting and talk about that. Go to that meeting you were going to take him to and talk about it." So that's what I did. But at the end of the phone call, this guy said, "Thank you for calling. It is nice to hear from somebody with real problems, and gives me a chance to," he said this, "gives me a chance to get my," shall we say, "head out of my butt." And I realized that, whatever I'm going through all disappears when somebody reaches out to me for help. And when I get to walk through the steps with somebody and to share what I've been given, that man from Boston that I spent some time with this past weekend, he really helped save my life. And I can't really pay him back, but I can pass it on. That's how I pay people back. And I've had sponsees that, they say, "Thank you, Carol." And I go, "Oh, no, thank you." And they go, "What?" And they don't get it. And I said, "When you have a sponsee, you're going to get this." And they come back to me later and they said, "Yeah, I got it." Because you think you're giving help, but you're receiving help. To tell my story, to give you my story, I have to go back through that sucker. And I have to look at all what I went through. I meant to do a drunk-a-log because I really thought that it was funny that all the things that I did, you know, but I didn't realize how sick an alcoholic was. I didn't realize, I thought everybody mixed screwdrivers before high school. I thought, you know, my senior class, at least my first senior class, you didn't get that, did you? My first time I went through my senior year in high school, I was drinking and mixing screwdrivers and probably a joint or two before I went to class. And I quit school realizing that if I went to school, if I graduated at all, it would be with D's. So I did what any red-blooded American boy would do. I quit school and joined the circus. I was a pilot in the circus. I used to follow behind the horses and the elephants with a shovel and pilot in the bucket. I was a prop man. We'd set up the show. We'd pull it out of a truck and go into the arena or the armory or the high school gym or the college gym. I met them at U-Haul. And we'd pull everything out, set it up, run the show, break it down, stick it back in the truck, and go to the next place and do it again. And I did that for a while, and then I went back. But I thought all that stuff was funny and getting pulled by cops. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't think I had a problem. I didn't think that, you know, drinking a bottle of vodka every day was that big a deal. I didn't think about when I came back and went to my second senior year, I was legal to drink. And I could have a beer for lunch every day. So I'd get a six-pack for lunch every day. And but there's nothing wrong in that, what everybody does, you know? And that's what I thought. And then AAC made me start looking back on this and realizing that wasn't normal. That I've got a disease, a life-threatening disease, that could kill me if I don't do what I need to do, if I don't work the steps. So today I don't really work the steps. I try to live the steps. I try to live them as best I can. And one last thing, I've got all these years and I'm still a human being and I still have problems. And I've told this story, but there's a new part that just happened, so I'm going to tell the story again. About 6 months ago, I was with a co-worker, and he said something I didn't like. I really took offense. I mean, I really took offense. I ran straight to the prayer closet. And I had a talk with me, and I had a talk with God, and I came out, and I went to my manager, and I said, I want you to come in here. I was real calm. I said, I want you to come in here, and I want to confront this dude, because he said something I didn't like. And he said, Carol, I think you're upset, and I think you want to go on your break right now. And I had a 15-minute break, so I took my 15-minute break. I went across the parking lot to this little stand of woods, and I called my sponsor, and I had a 19-minute call with my sponsor and a 10-minute call with my wife because I wanted to kill this mofo. I wanted to go back. I mean, my anger, I call it the gorilla in the cage. I wanted to let that sucker out, and I'm holding that thing in because I am afraid. You know, in my house, the saying is, don't pull out an Uzi when a squirt gun is all what's needed, you know? And I wanted to go back at him and get him, and I am so angry. I am so angry. I am talking to my sponsor, and this is a true dry drunk. I am staggering. I'm staggering. I am holding foot. I am crying. I am so angry. I can't stand it. I've got all these years. I'm still doing this stuff. I've still got this. And so I calmed down. And I went back, and I worked with the guy for about an hour, and then he clocked out, and I walked over, and with some prompting from my wife who said, don't get in an argument with him, I said, I didn't like what you said. And I really was hurt by that. Well, you should have, I didn't like what you said, and I was really hurt by that. Well, you shouldn't, I didn't like what you said, and I was really hurt by that. And he said, well, then I guess we can't work the register because that's what the issue was. I'd come back from a break or some from the back, and I jumped in, and he was upset at who I waited on. He thought they were out of turn. And he said, I guess we can't work the register. And I realized, wait a minute, I did make a mistake. And I owe this guy 10 step. And I said, okay, I'll tell you what. From now on, when I come back, I will ask you what you want me to do. I'll ask you where you are. And I will jump in where you tell me. And he says, okay, I can live with that. And he puts his hand out. This guy never apologizes about anything. He puts his hand out, and he shakes hands and says, if I hurt your feelings, I'm really sorry. And you could have bought me for a penny. but you could have bought me less probably 6 months later. We're working together. And I've been cleaning out my act because I realized that I'm that third step guy, the actor that wants to be the director. And for years, people hated working with me because I was trying to run the show, because I was so darn scared that I'd get blamed for other people's mistakes, and I was correcting everybody's mistakes so I wouldn't get blamed for them. And one day I called my sponsor and I said I had this problem, and he started describing a coworker who was a nag, who was the manager's pet. And I'm like, oh my God, that's me. He described me. I sit there and start crying. So I'm cleaning up my act with this guy. This guy I wanted to kill 6 months ago. I'm cleaning up my act. I am not telling him what to do. If he wants to stand there and look at his phone for half an hour while I work my butt off, go for it. Because it's not my business what he does. My business is doing my best job I can do. So I do my job, and I help train this other worker. And then this guy all of a sudden is starting to pick up work more and starting to work together, and we're working tighter. And Friday he asked me to come to his wedding, which was the most amazing thing, because it's not that I'm a great guy and all. I'm living this step, this 10th step. I'm living this. And I'm praying. That thing in the back of the book, pray for somebody for 2 weeks. I started on March 16th, and I'm still praying for 4 people. He's one of them. God worked that miracle. I saw one the other day, and I actually treated her very human and felt sorry for her. I'm going to spend a week with one of them next week. I think it's actually, we're not going to kill each other. And the other one, I'm waiting for God to make the move to see how I can make amends to that person. So my life has changed. This is not who walked in the door. I'm wrapping up now. This is not who walked in the door. The person who walked in the door and the person who I am today are so different. I didn't have that burning bush. What I had was, I love it when somebody explained, if you could take the day you came in and now, and you could erase everything in between, like 1 second I'm that and 1 second I'm this, that's the miracle. It would amaze you if you saw who I was and then who I am. And yet, I didn't do it. Grace of God, I didn't do it. AA did it. I just followed what y'all said, and I worked with people, and I grew a heart, and I grew responsibility. And I'm here today, not having to drink, and not worrying about drinking, at least before I go to bed tonight. Thank you for letting me share. I appreciate the honor.